Welcome to Harmonious Workplaces, a podcast about corporate culture, organizational change management, and workplace behavior. Harmonious Workplaces was started by independent consultants Rich Cruz, Ben Kleinman, and Cheryl Volpe to explore, challenge, and build on various organizational culture and change management concepts. It's a blend of theory and practice based on their personal and professional experiences working with companies of all sizes across various industries. If you own a business, lead a team, want new ideas about the corporate environment, or just want to listen to a group of consultants talking about how to make work more enjoyable, we invite you to sit back, relax, and dive in with us to Harmonious Workplaces. And welcome back to the Harmonious Workplaces podcast. And we are in episode 8. And today we're going to be talking about overcoming resistance to change. And, you know, it just dawned on me that if we were a Netflix series, we'd actually have wrapped up the season. But we're not doing that. We're going to keep going. So today...
Extending the season. Breaking boundaries. By popular demand.
Oh my gosh, it's going to be like those old the old serials where there's like 20 something in a season. So
nice.
I'm Rich Cruz, and I'm joined here with Ben Kleinman. Hey Ben.
Hi.
And Cheryl Volpe. Hey Cheryl.
Hi everyone.
And we are going to talk a little bit more about change. In the last few episodes,
I don't want to talk about change.
You don't want to talk about what do you mean?
I'm resistant. Wait,
what? We can't.
I'm just going to sandbag this episode.
Look, this whole time we were ready to go. Wait a second. Hold on. All right. Well,
and then, I see what
it could be. It could be like a working podcast.
Yeah. Yes.
Let's get Kleinman to change in real time.
Oh, we need a coalition of support. And
there you go.
Yeah, that's right. So
peer pressure. Yeah. We need to dig deep into my internal motivation, make sure I'm psychologically safe and all of these great things.
That's right. Clearly. And that's what we're going to be talking about today, folks.
So, I love it.
Yeah.
I love it.
Getting change is really important for organizations. And yet it's super hard because it involves a lot of different people and they have different perspectives and goals and needs. And, not to mention different levels of internal motivation or ability to change. And unfortunately, not everyone's on board with what's needed and they might resist your efforts. And, you know, you need to change their minds so that you can facilitate, well, you know, that change. So
I've been thinking about this a bunch since we had first started thinking about talking about this.
Yeah.
It's a lot of thinking and thinking. I'm struggling with how you scale tackling resistance to change because I keep thinking it comes back to one person or a group of people trying to convince a person who's struggling with the change or a person who's actively resisting the change or passively aggressively resisting the change. And how do you scale that? Because if you have a company like we've talked about, you know, you're kind of interested in that 20 to 25, 30 odd people company, that's a smaller group. You can sit with someone and you can sort of work through whatever that person's issues are or whatever that person's concerns are and help them kind of see the light. But if you have a company that's global, that's 30,000 people or 50,000 people or 10, even 1,000 people, how do you scale that? Because you can't just go to 200 people individually. That's
a daunting task, right? Well, that's a really good question, Ben, and I for one can say I have only been part of one global organization that made that kind of a change, and it was a long process. You know, what it really took was winning over certain groups and then expanding that out and this kind of ripple effect that happened, right? But boy, some parts of the world were super resistant and you have to kind of roll with the punches and adapt to their culture, you know. So
Yeah. But that's a really good question. And I hope our listeners, you know, have some ideas, and we'd love to hear some of
them. Yeah, I would love that. If people have cracked that nut. Yeah. I'd love to have any best practices or guidance come in on that. Maybe what we do is we kind of step back to where I think we were trying to start this episode, thinking about overcoming resistance and maybe on more of an individual level and setting the stage with that, and then seeing how that can ripple out to a department or groups of people. Maybe it's groups of people that are individuals just located in different places, but in a collective sense, that's just dragging. It's like headwinds against the whole change thing. So maybe we kind of rewind a little bit and start with just one person.
I
do think, though, Rich, your direction with the idea of having key people in different areas sort of bring one or two teams on board, and then that does create the ripple effect. So it does depend on still the individuals and individuals who are identified to lead that communication within the group. And these folks tend to be more successful when they are identified as people who are more inclined to inspire and motivate their team with that trust. And it still has to start on an individual basis and then ripple out.
Like a trusted colleague or a mentor, trusted mentor, or someone in the company that everyone looks up to, have that person lean in a bit then, is what you're suggesting with that individual?
That is what I'm suggesting.
Yeah, okay.
We've all been in the situations where none of that happens. And here's the change, and you are doing it, and this has been decided already. Mm-hmm. And, you know, varying degrees of success with that sort of just forcing. Absolutely.
Yep. Well, why don't we set the stage here, just to go back to Ben, you had mentioned in our notes here some reasons why companies would change. Just to go through that, because I think that kind of sets the stage a little bit for why somebody would say, I don't want to do this. Like, you know.
Yeah. And this will be super high level, because we've talked about this quite a bit in other episodes. So if your folks are interested, they can go back and listen to some of the other episodes that have more details. But I was thinking about just kind of high level why an organization might change. And it seems like there were a few that jumped out to me, and maybe this is not an exhaustive list, but it seems like at one level, there's a social imperative. So I do a lot of work in the healthcare sector. It's an opportunity to create a new medical device or a new drug, develop a new drug that's going to help a group of patients. And as an organization, you feel like you're sort of socially driven to do that. It's maybe mission driven, and it's less about the profit incentive. It's about, we have an obligation to do something for society. Okay, so there's that. And it means we're going to have to change some of the way we do things, but it's an obligation. We have to do something for society. There's always the second thing I was thinking. There's always profit motive. We can enter an adjacent market. We can enter a new market. We've got some tool or technology that's easily scalable. We can take it to new customers, make a boatload of money. Certainly valid. Existential threat was the third thing I was thinking. So if we don't change, our company will go out of business because other people are doing it better, faster, cheaper, what have you. And so we have to change. And that's a little bit more of that, like, it feels like a little bit more of a negative pressure than something like a social obligation or chasing more money or things like that. So there was that one. And then the last one I was thinking of was more around the idea of employee benefits. So we're not necessarily going to make more money. We're not necessarily going to serve new customers or better society. It was really about, we're just going to make some changes, but it's going to make our employees so much happier. We're going to get rid of an old junky clunky system and make it cutting edge, modern, easy to interface, or we're going to get rid of really gunky processes and make it super easy. Like, instead of 17 layers of approval to get funding to buy a new pack of pencils, we're just going to make it so you can just go buy a pack of pencils. No worries there, right? So it's that kind of stuff. It doesn't necessarily make the company a lot of money, or that's not the intention. It's more about keeping your employees happy and keeping your employees engaged. And maybe that makes for a better culture overall. So those were, I mean, just off the top of my head, four reasons why a company might want to change. Mm-hmm. What am I missing there? And is that enough to sort of set the stage for overcoming resistance in those areas?
Yeah, I think that I think that's really good, because like if we went into like what a technology changes, it can fit into any one of those categories, right? Yeah, if it's a process change, it fits into any one of those categories. So those are really good examples. So thanks for that, Ben. And that having been said, I think this does set the stage, because you know, when you look at each one of these, the individual, like you were saying, Cheryl, the individual person has their feelings about this, right? And they're, you know, frankly, they should be entitled to their feelings. They're not always felt that. Made to feel that way, but you know, there's you know, it becomes a very personal thing when any of these considerations happen, right? So people start having fears about how is this going to affect me personally, how is this going to affect me socially, I'm not familiar with this, so I'm totally uncomfortable with that. And then, you know, this lack of understanding of what's going to happen, and, you know, communication can backfire and all that stuff. So, yeah, know that you hit on that. Great.
Cheryl, before you jump in, just, and maybe this will help color your answer a little bit. Does resistance to change vary based on the reason for the change? So for example, if we're changing because if we don't do it, we're going to go out of business, and I'm resisting that because it means that my job might change, or I might have to take a lower salary or whatever, does that resistance differ than if we're making a change to make, let's say, more money in a new industry or an adjacent industry? Or does that differ from if we're making a change because we want to make life better for employees overall? So does that make any sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm super curious what the literature says on that, what you think about all that.
Sure. I think that when you talk about different reasons as catalysts for change, there are certain things that are going to be the same, no matter what the reason is. Where people resist each of those reasons, though, is the real differentiating factor for leaders to tune into and lean into and understand. If we are going to go out of business without this change, and I still have key people or anyone that is clearly resisting that change, that how the resistors talk about why they are resisting that change is very, very important, because then that identifies their motivation. And if I don't see it as a dire situation and I am resisting change, that is very important for a leader to identify, in that maybe that person should be in a different job. You know, if it could come down to that. So I think the reasons for resisting are very important to identify the what managers need to focus on to break that resistance down. I know that might sound really obvious, but I think that listening is often overlooked in the face of the change.
Right. I've got to say, I mean, whenever there's been some major change that's happened within a lot of the organizations I've worked at, I can't say all the time, right? But there's not always this, so how does that make you feel? Right. Or there's not always that, that eliciting the feedback, right? That part oftentimes gets cut off, you know? That's super important. And I think that's why we're gathered here to talk about this, right?
Right. And those blind spots can be the difference between keeping your company open and having to close. If you don't have the importance, if you don't prioritize having those conversations, you know, and that's often where we can discover as leaders that it's not so much about the technical change or the fear of learning or the fear of changing, but a lot of times there is that social change, what this new process represents, less engagement with another teammate or less respect for what I do in this process if my role is being diminished. It's that social fear, which also cannot be identified when there's no audience or questions to share that kind of information.
How would you overcome that? If someone came to you and said, Cheryl, I can't get behind this. It means I'm going to be demoted, or it means I'm going to not be seen as the go-to person for X, Y, or Z. And that's who I am in this company. That's who I am in my personal world. I'm the guy at work who people go to for new packs of pencils. Sure. I can't get behind that, losing Rich. That identity.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have anything to offer on that, Rich? I have a couple of ideas.
Well, yeah, I mean, I that identity issue is a huge thing. We've, you know, in one of those Erickson stages, you know, that we fought for, like, was that almost like 15, 20 years of our lives to build this identity, right? And then we're like, oh, you're taking that away from me, you know, because this, like you said, this is who I am. So it does become a, you know, again, it's a deeply personal way for people to change. But I think one of those things that I can say is talking about those, you know, the tying everything to those organizational goals, but also tying them to, like, somebody's personal career goals, right? And that's where that kind of those gaps where we identify where somebody is and where they could be, you know, could come into play. Now, does everybody want to be that person that, you know, is ready to go to the next level? Nope. I know plenty of people who are like, I've been doing the same job for 20 years and I want to keep doing this job for 20 years, but unfortunately that's not always the case, you know? So, you know, I, for one thing, I think having you know, those open discussions with somebody, really listening to them more than talking, which is the opposite of what I'm doing right now. And, you know, I think that's one thing. The other thing is when you can get other people to help and support that, you know, find those people who are connected to somebody, and have them help influence that move. You know, somebody who may be a friend or a colleague or even a, you know, even a subordinate or a manager, you know, to help move things along. That's one thing that I found to be fairly effective.
My ideas are all connected to yours. The idea that you could engage a person who is resisting change on a level that gives them the optimism or the encouragement that maybe they could work on a different project that is more interesting to them. Maybe they can have a greater influence on something different in a different department if they are no longer satisfied because of the change where they are. There are paths that you can take that would inspire more engagement in a different area. Maybe a employee can be brought into another kind of change at an earlier stage in a different way or on a different part of the business. It doesn't always work out that way, though. That is true. Sometimes they're just, your job could become obsolete, you know, and that comes back to what are your personal goals? you know, what can we help you discover about yourself that could change your path or give you a new chapter at something else?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Absolutely. Ben, you have any, what have you done? You've been doing this for organizations.
Well, I was just thinking about some of the stuff you guys were sharing there. And it seems like if I step back a little bit and you think about ways to overcome resistance to change, people often think about throwing money at the problem, you know, bigger bonuses, incentives, you know, throwing Starbucks cards at it or pizza parties or whatever. So that's something that people do. We've talked before about how that has varying levels of success. And I don't think that works in the case where we're talking about right now, where you have someone who's very personally identified with that role that's being changed or very personally identified with the status that comes with a role. Throwing money at that won't help. I feel like some of where you're going in terms of sitting with that person, helping that person understand why this is a change that's so necessary. If that person already understands that, that's great. Then you can move past. If that person hasn't understand that, then that's a good place to start. If that person understands it and they're still resisting, then I think, Cheryl, you're right about how that can then be, well, what other ways can you contribute? Can you find a new identity at this company to help us be where we all want to be? You get a new status as instead of the person who's, you know, the pencil purchaser person, now you're going to be the printer person who does things with printers or whatever. I mean, it's just like a new thing. Maybe there's a way to help that person find a new identity that meets the vision of the new direction the company's going in. But I go back to something else that you guys were both saying earlier in terms of creating a sort of safety zone, and I'm trying not to call it peer pressure, but it's basically that peer pressure of other people who have already gone through that change curve and who are now fully or mostly embracing that change, saying, come on, Ben, it's not going to be that bad. You'll see. It's all good. Right. We're here. We've got you. So it's a little bit of that safety beanbag that I keep going back to. And it's a little bit of that peer pressure. And it doesn't have to be peer pressure in a negative way, but it has to be that sort of social acceptance of the change. And that gives a little bit of cover for that person to say, all right, I'll change my mind or I'll try it. I'll give it a week. Right. And it helps that overcome that resistance in a more sort of chisel at it very slowly kind of way. Cause I think if it's personal identity, that's a tough one. That's a tough one. And I don't know how you scale that to keep going back to my original question.
Oh yeah. On a large scale like that, boy,
on a micro level, it's doable. Sure. Or maybe on a department or a small group of people, it's doable. I'm setting aside unions because that's a whole different issue. But if you have a large group of people that are either a cohesive unit, a cohesive function, or that are dispersed throughout the company, but just all these individuals add up to enough of a weight, it's hard to do that individual check-in unless you have a lot of individual managers or managers that are dispersed that can meet with people one-on-one, or there, you know, is enough space carved out for those people to go meet with sandbaggers. And I guess then that leads me to the question of, at what point do you cut bait?
Right.
You know, at what point do you say, as an organization, we've tried as much as we possibly can. We've given as much time, we've spent as much money, we've changed as much as we can to bring this person or these groups of people along. It ain't working. It's not that we don't like them, but they're not contributing enough to where we need to be. And they're actively sandbagging or resisting or just not moving. They're starting to corrupt our new culture. We can't let that happen for the benefit of the whole.
Right. Right.
Right. I would like to say,
go ahead. Sorry, sure.
Oh, I just wanted to say, as you were talking, Ben, that, you know, the culture of a company informs a person before they even work at that company or as they're applying, before they join that culture. Some companies have a culture that you already understand walking into it, that you're going to be part of a large team. Change isn't always spoon-fed or handheld. It may be a very dynamic environment that is at 50,000 employees already. So there's going to be a expectation that that culture will be less individual with certain changes. Mm-hmm. So I think the expectation of the culture that you're a part of can help some of that resistance. You wouldn't want to just draw a line in the sand and start sandbagging in an environment that you already understood is all about change all the time with large groups of people, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it's harder when a company starts as a small company and then starts to grow. Those growth pains make it even more complex. What were you going to say, Rich, about?
Well, there are two things. One, it was, I think you're talking about cut bait. Like, I mean, there you have to, that resistance can become a virus, like, I mean, it spreads, right? And it can become really detrimental to the whole change process and unravel it pretty quickly, right? But well, the other thing I was thinking about was in those larger organizations, and I'm thinking about some of the organizational behavior literature out there about the size of work groups, right? Where, you know, kind of what, correct me if I'm wrong, but I seem to recall optimal size of work groups is like between 8 and 14 or 8 and 12 or something like that, right? Where, you know, 8 to any lower than 8, you don't get the diversity of thought that you probably should have within a group, right? Where any more than that 12 or 14, now it's, you know, there's too much conflict, you know, that can happen there. But if you
was that from literature stuff that you guys were studying?
It is, and I'd have to go back and take a look at where that came from. I remember it came from our organizational behavior textbook, but it does come from several meta analyses, uh-huh. Right? But
only reason I ask is just because that's something that I think it was Jeff Bezos was pretty well known for, is saying that his ideal team size is like 2 pizzas.
Yeah, right. That makes sense. I love that.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Easy to carry, not too much.
It's just like if you're feeding more than 2 pizzas worth of people. Now, I eat a lot of pizza, so I'm skewing the group size. But in general, for most normal human beings, I think that works out to something like 8-ish people, right? You figure 2 slices a person.
That's right.
So yeah. There you go. Yeah. Sorry, I'm taking way off track. Back to you.
Because I don't eat pizza anymore. So Chicago that doesn't eat pizza. Oh, but
you're out.
Yeah, I'm out. Right,
you've lost your. Looking in. You can only vote once now.
Boom. Ah, Chicago.
It's Chicago humor. 42.1% of people won't get that joke.
Yeah, that's right. But so I think if an organization can think about that during this process, and even at like some OD interventions like World Cafes, where you've got people set up at tables, you're still breaking them up into those smaller groups because they can talk to each other, right? And they have that diversity of thought, but they're small enough where they can be controlled, or that not that they can be controlled, not like you're manipulating it, but where you're not the puppet master, but you know where it's not going, you know, it's not spiraling out of control, right? I think when you have that and you can have a change champion from like your, here's a concept, planning and implementation team, right? Your PIT, that came from Alan Landers and there's other literature that talks about PITs, but, you know, this planning and implementation team would be a group of change agents, right, that come together to help plan this change initiative and then keep it rolling. But if you can embed some of those change agents into those smaller work groups, you have a little bit of a better chance to you know, overcome resistance. And if anything, identify who's there to figure out what levers you need to push to pull, you know.
Go ahead, Cheryl.
What I love about the PIT acronym, the planning and implementation team, it's also sort of like a pit stop. You know, if this was a group of people on that team that could be trusted, could be gone to, like, here's your team. This is like the team that you go to for any number of problems, including your resistance. They will show you how it is futile.
Yeah. Change your tires, wipe your windows.
Yeah.
Send you on your way.
Exactly. And not just, you know, pounding the goals and objectives and the mission, but this would be a team of people where you could have that safety to say, you know, here are my issues. Here are my problems with this whole thing.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It leverages, I want to say this one, we mentioned it a couple of episodes ago, but LMX theory, leader member exchange theory, where you have these in-groups and you have these out-groups, right? So that in-group becomes a cohesive group, right? And so they can, you feel safer within that group to say what you want to and to interact there, right? Of course, the risks are always that group think that could happen within that and all that. But
right, and alienating the out-group all of those things, yeah.
But I was going to ask you both, in your experience, change agents, I think you called them, Rich, or change champions. I've heard both. I've seen both in the corporate world. And I'm curious, do you guys see those change agents, change champions as people who are more of the doer level, or are they more of the visionary inspirer level? Right. So are they boots on the ground, or are they folks setting direction?
Let me ask you that question.
Or could it be both?
What do you say?
Me? I'm
gonna throw it at you.
You can't do that.
I just did. I just
yeah. I think where I'm going to go is that I think the idea of having embedded people is a good idea because it gives you the pulse of what's happening in small groups that are being impacted by the change. I think where it works best is when those people have some power or agency or some level of authority to do something with that resistance. So it's less effective if it's just me sitting there, here. I'm part of the team, and all I'm doing is gathering up feedback. And sometimes it's good. Sometimes I'm going to say, go back to that change team or the change leader or someone, or maybe I go back to the pit stop and sit on the beanbag and share how this group is doing on a Tuesday or whatever. Sometimes it's going to be really good. Sometimes it's going to be like, hey, this is going well, but let's just tweak this. Or, you know, instead of coffee, could we have latte this week? We know we're a little sick of the coffee, that kind of thing. And sometimes it's going to be like, man, this group is just hating life. We got to go do it differently. I think it's going to work a little better if that person also has the ability to say, I hear what you're saying. I'm glad you're telling me that this is not working out. Let's work on making it better. Let's sit here and do this right now, or let's schedule time next week and we're all going to kind of co-create how this can be differently. It's going to be easier, better, faster, smoother for everyone if the people who are struggling with the change know that that person has some way to make things better, as opposed to it's just, I'm reporting out my dissatisfaction and it's not going to go anywhere, or it's going to take 3 quarters. And by then we're already into a new fiscal year. And, you know, this effort has gone by the by, right? It's something that's got to be addressable in the moment. I think that works better. Yeah. And the only other thing I'll append to that is, I think when you have that sort of quote unquote leadership level, setting the direction, championing the change, you know, really trumpeting the vision, but also making themselves available, and not that they would come and sit in on every single team meeting. There's no way that's realistic, but that they could be reinforcing those messages over bite-sized videos that anyone could access at any time on a corporate intranet, or that they could come to quarterly all-staff meetings, or that they could come to functional get-togethers periodically, something like that, where they can just say, hey, I'm here, I'm available, I'm listening, I'm open for suggestions, I've got your back, I'm super excited for this change, I want to make sure you are as well, let's do all this together. I think that can help quite a bit, especially when those leaders are really well-respected. If it's Uncle Scrooge, that's a totally different story. But if it's a well-respected leader, that can help a lot, because people see that person as being very active, very invested in the change, and very available for comments, suggestions, feedback, what have you. So it's a little bit of both.
So somebody, so you're saying it's to have that peer influencer would have to have some degree of power, whether it's legitimate power, power that's given to them to make something happen, or reward power. They have the ability to, you know, distribute rewards, or like referent power, where they are seen as an expert and people go to them for, you know, this or the other. It may not be legitimate in the sense that somebody gave it to them, but if you're going for, if you get somebody who is coercive, you know, they have that kind of punishment power, that's probably going to be.
No, because you figure everybody's got a line manager. That's the person with the coercive power. So they already have that. Right. But I think where it helps is a lot of the change champions, at least that I've seen, tend to be well-respected peers, people that are seen as someone who everyone can easily talk to, that person. So it's not going to be someone who's, you know, like that offstanding person who nobody wants to interact with. That's a non-starter. But even if you have someone who's well-respected by peers, they're going to be able to feel comfortable talking to that person. But if all that person can do is once a month take feedback back to the central team, the PIT, or whoever's running that change initiative, I feel like that's not going to get you moving, but it's not going to help a ton. If that person had just a little bit of agency to say, oh, well, that's a problem, let's figure that out right now, or I've got the power to order two pizzas, let's have lunch and get our team together and sit around and think about ways we could do it. Now I don't have to wait a month. I can say we've either figured it out as a team because we have enough power to do that as a team, or I can say team struggling with this, we've come up with two options. I can run that up to whoever's going to green light that. And within a week, you can have that sorted. You can do that all over email or a phone call or whatever. And that just makes those people who are struggling with the change feel heard, feel like they've done something to contribute to a positive outcome. And even if that outcome is not as positive as they were hoping, at least they got some pizza out of it and they got listened to.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely a social reward that they get with that.
I'm taking my pizza, going home.
Taking it and going home. And imagine how quickly the trust in that process would erode. We've all been there too, I'm going to guess, where that person to whom you confided in or escalated a problem to, and they say to you, I'll have to talk to so-and-so about that, I'll get back to you. And then how many times will you not get back to, you know, it dies on the vine and never comes up again. That trust will erode so quickly. Contrast that with that succinct, crisp follow-up that has an actual effect, right?
Right, right.
So important. And some people, you know, some leaders think, well, they didn't really expect me to escalate that. Or even worse, they do escalate it to their superior person and they're shot down. Yeah. They still have to go back to the hive and communicate that, you know. That's a terrible position to be in, though, right? That happens too.
Well, let's wrap up on a positive note. Let's kind of sum up some of these some of the things that we can take away today, you know.
So, I was just thinking that.
Yeah.
So, it's about time. So about
time. I was thinking it too.
Right on.
I love that we're doing the collective mind meld.
Yes.
Some of the stuff that I've heard us talk about here, that summarizing our conversation, that leaders need to listen into the why. Why are people struggling with change? Why are they resisting it? What have you? But they need to really listen in so they can understand how to help that person or that group overcome resistance. So that's one thing we've spent some time talking about. So listening is key. We've also talked about how peers can help influence people resisting change. And some of it's going to be support. Some of it's going to be showing or modeling social acceptance of that change and putting a little bit of pressure on that person not to be that outlier, not to be the curmudgeon resisting change. And some of it's going to be a little bit of that active, hey, come on, it's not that bad. And sort of that social pressure not to be that outlier. So it's sort of a trifecta there. And then the third thing I was thinking that we talked a bit about was keeping an eye out on the overall culture and making sure that the culture, even though it's going through a big churn, transformation initiative, change initiative, whatever, that culture is still pretty healthy, and just kind of keeping your eye out for that.
Sure.
What I missed there from summaries, and then we can get into actions to take, but from a summary perspective.
Well, I think one of the other things might be also to take a look at the design of the organization. So to facilitate some of that peer pressure, right? Or not pressure, but that peer influence, right? To consider the design. So consider that PIT, that planning implementation team, and who's part of that, but then also what are those work groups look like? Don't make them too large, too small, so that you can have some influence. That could help to facilitate some of that.
Ashamed I missed the pizza.
The pizza.
How could I?
Two pizzas. Remember that.
There you go.
And Rich, going to your point about how those groups are constructed, back to what you were talking about too, Ben, you know, are the groups autonomous? Do they have a hierarchy within them that has that person in a position of authority or power that can take the concerns to the next level and affect change? Or are they all peers with only intermediate access to more authority?
Right.
And yep. How does that work when there's change happening? Yeah.
Yep. Cool.
Yeah, I like that idea of a one-stop shop for all things change.
Yeah.
It's nice. Okay, actions to take. If you are in the middle of a change and you're looking for things to do differently, ways to make it go better, I was hearing from what we were talking about that there has to be some intentionality about listening to people. So that goes back to listening, what we were talking about originally, carving out some time, being really intentional about carving out some time, whether it's office hours or coming to team meetings or running pulse check surveys or something like that, that you then come back to people and you say, I've heard this and I'm acting on this, but being intentional about listening and making that a part of your day.
And I want to pause you there, Ben. It's, you know, we've talked in previous episodes about how do we measure the effects of the change and is it successful? These feedback loops are more about the individuals and the people and how they are seeing the change and how they are coping with change. And it's less about the performance evaluation and more about the evaluation of the experience.
Yeah. Great point. This is all about the change itself and how the change is going and not, are you doing your job kind of stuff? And so very, very good distinction. Thank you for clarifying that. Yep. For sure.
And that evaluation though, those pulse check surveys are really nice though, because they do give you some quantifiable and quality feedback, you know, that you can measure across the whole continuum of that change process, which is great. So, we should talk more about those in a future episode.
I like it. Monitoring change, tracking things over time, seeing trends, that can be a great thing to talk about at another time. Somebody should remember that.
I'm going to write it down.
While you're writing that down, we'll do it. Thank you. Thank you, Cheryl, for writing that down. Another action people can take is to identify change agents, change champions, change concierges, whatever we're calling these folks, but identify those people throughout your organization that have some level of peer respect or informal power or referential power, something like that. So identify those people ideally ahead of time. If you're in the middle of a change, find those people as soon as you can, because those people will help you massage the change and message the change throughout in multi directions and all of that. So that's going to be important to do. And then the third action that I was hearing, we were just spending some time talking about towards the end of our episode today, is the idea that you want to empower those people to be able to do something in the moment to help a team or help a person co-create a better future. And so whether that's sitting around and listening to someone and just being that psychological safety valve, or whether it's sitting around and helping a team co-create, well, I know we want to get here and you want us to go like that. We're going to go like that because it's better for our team. That can often be a really good outcome, and having that change agent have the ability to say, that's fine, you do it, you make it happen, we've got you. That can be a really, really positive thing.
Yep. Yep. Keeps the momentum going. Adds
in real time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Super important.
Reduces the friction.
Right. Right.
Great. Awesome. Okay. Well, so we hope that you've taken away some great information here, some actionable items that you can start putting into your change processes at any time. And tune in next time for Harmonious Workplaces, where we will be talking more about how we're going to be making your organizations a little more harmonious. So,
love it.
Yeah. Well, thanks.
Thank you both.
All right. Thank you both. It's been great.
See you all later. Take care.
See you again.
Thanks for listening to Harmonious Workplaces. You can find Harmonious Workplaces on LinkedIn, Twitter, YouTube, Spotify, Amazon, Apple, and other streaming platforms. We'd love any feedback on whatever channel you find us on. Please rate, like, and share our podcast with your network. And remember to add Harmonious Workplaces to your list of favorites to get notified about each new episode. To contact Rich or Cheryl, please visit www.workbalanceconsulting.com. To connect with Ben, find him on LinkedIn or visit at www.harborsidestrategy.com.